This chapel message is brought to you by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations.
So I'm Grant Correll. I'm a family medicine physician. I have been doing GHO trips since the 1980s. I've been leading GHO trips since the 1990s. Spoke for the Saline Solution for over a decade. I'm the faculty advisor for our QCOM CMDA group probably for 30 years now, and have spoken at both local and national meetings for CMDA over the years. And I say all that because my identity as a physician has been integral to CMDA, or as the NAV system this morning called it, SIMDA. I don't know who I would be today as a doctor if it hadn't been for this organization. So much of my formation as a physician has come through this organization. And I want to encourage you and thank you for all the work that you guys do, because you are transforming the lives of doctors so that we can impact and transform the lives of our patients. The work that you do each day is extremely important. And so thank you very much for having me here and for the work that you guys do. So how many of you like word games? Maybe somebody does some Wordle, right? Or Words with Friends, or maybe if you're an older generation, Scrabble or Boggle or the New York Times crossword puzzle in the newspaper. For the 20-something-year-olds, I have to explain what a newspaper is. There was this piece of paper that would come. Just Google it. Just Google it. Look it up. So how many of you are actually doing, like, Wordle right now in the middle of the talk, right? Yeah, thank you. By the way, today's word, six letters, starts with W. Today's word for Wordle is actually Wordle. Should probably have said spoiler alert. But anyway, yeah, so today's word is Wordle. So we're going to do a little wordplay today. We're going to have some fun, and then we're going to use that as a way of making some conclusions about what's going on in healthcare. So in a former academic life, before I got into medicine, I actually studied linguistics, and it was fascinating. Etymology is the study of the origin of language, where words and phrases and ideas come from. And I was at one point actually studying proto-languages. Proto-languages are the languages before the current language that we have, or what in the past morphed into what we have in the present. And outside of a few dusty academics, nobody speaks proto-languages anymore, but you can read them. But more importantly is you can learn where language came from and how it developed. And so we're going to do that today. And to do that, we're going to go back in history about half of a millennia to the Middle Ages. This, by the way, for the 20-somethings, this is Doc Brown, who was not a doctor, he was a scientist. And he built a time machine out of a DeLorean, it was a car company, and then the CEO got caught for cocaine trafficking. Just Google it. You guys look it up, okay? Just Google it. But we're going to go back to the future here. We're going to go backwards in time, and we're going to look a little bit about what life was like in the medieval period, okay? So in the Middle Ages, it is true that people were suspicious of water, and I didn't have a microscopic understanding of the world, but you got to hand it to them. They knew that whenever they drank the water, they got sick. So water was somewhat suspicious, but you also needed water to be able to keep yourself clean. So it's this sort of funny oxymoronical relationship with water. But usually after the winter was gone and the spring had, was finishing out, before you would hit the summer, you would take your yearly bath. This is, by the way, why women have weddings usually in May or June, because it was historically done right after your yearly bath. And the reason you carry flowers is because they were aromatic, and so sometimes they helped mask over the odor that was still there residually. And when you got married and you didn't need the flowers anymore, what did you do with the bouquet? You tossed it into the crowd, and an unmarried woman would get those. But everybody... had at least a yearly bath, and they would draw up a bath water, and the father would start first, and then he would be followed by the eldest son, and then every son in succession, and then the women would go ahead and bathe, starting with the mother, and then eventually the last person to bathe would be the infant child. And as you can imagine, and as this picture shows, the bath water would get very, very dirty. It would get so dirty you couldn't see the bottom of it. And the old joke was you had to be careful when you disposed of the water, because if the infant child was still in there playing, you didn't want to get rid of them, and that's where the phrase, don't throw the baby out with the bath water, comes from. Okay, this is a medieval house. Typically, they had thatched roofs. Thatch is nothing more than hay, it's straw. And they would cut it and they would bundle it together and they would actually have it 3, 4, sometimes 5 feet thick on the roof. It was cheap, it was easy to find, it was easy to replace, and actually was a pretty good insulator. Matter of fact, a little survival tip, if you're ever out in the woods and it's the middle of winter and you have to stay warm, if you find a haystack, go inside of the haystack. There's a microorganism that is breaking down the hay that actually produces heat, and that's why if you look in the wintertime, you'll see smoke or heat coming off of haystacks. So it was actually a pretty good insulator. Matter of fact, so much so that a lot of the domestic animals, cats and even small dogs, would climb the rafters and would burrow in there because heat rose, right? And then heat was produced by the thatch. And if you were a cat, you know, the mice and other vermin were there as well, so you also got a little snack. It was sort of like DoorDash in your own bed. It was actually sort of neat. As good of an insulator as it was a terrible substance to use for waterproofing. And when it rained, particularly if it was a hard rain like we're getting now, the water would come through, and that would force the cats and dogs out of the thatch, and that's where the phrase, it's raining cats and dogs, comes from. All right, the houses were fairly basic. One of the big problems was the floor. They were usually made of dirt, and when you came in and you were wet, and you got it, just the floor became a mess. So if you had a little bit of money, you would get stone, and you would line the floor with stone. If you were really wealthy, you used porcelain or tile or something. But if you were really poor, you couldn't afford any of that, and that's why we called you dirt poor, because you had a dirt floor. If you had a dirt floor, this is how you would insulate. You would get that leftover thatch, that leftover thresh, that leftover hay, and you would put it on the bottom of the floor, and you would oftentimes stack it several feet thick. But every time you opened the door, that would all fall out. And so one of the things the medievals did is they would take a piece of wood and they would put it at the opening of the door to hold the thresh in. And that's where the term threshold comes from. Okay. Daily life, going to the butcher, you know, you had to go and get your meat. Just like today, there were more expensive cuts of meat, there were cheaper cuts of meat, and every once in a while, if you had made a little bit of extra money and you wanted to splurged, sort of like we go today and we get a filet mignon or lobster, something like that, you could go to the butcher and you could get pork, and pork was more expensive. And so that's where the phrase, I'm bringing home the bacon, comes from. Okay, and so when you got to the butcher to try to keep the meat as fresh as possible, because it didn't have any refrigeration systems, they would actually cut the meat when you showed up, and that was going to take them a little while. And so you know how today we go to a Mexican restaurant and you get a bowl of chips, or some restaurants will give you bread, and you sit around and wait for your meal to come. What they would do is they would trim off a piece of fat. And of course, fat you didn't want to eat necessarily, but you could chew on it like you did a piece of bubble gum, and you sort of swapped gossip with the butcher and found out what was going on, and that's where the term chewing the fat comes from. Okay. Going to the bakery was a necessity. Bread was a big part of what they ate every day. Unfortunately, their ovens weren't as always well-regulated as ones we have today, and so a lot of times the bread would be cooked well on one side and then burned on the other. And so when you brought it home, you would cut it up, and the servants would get the burned piece, but the nicely toasted piece, the upper crust, was given to the wealthiest person in the family, and that's where the term upper crust comes from. Alcohol was consumed on a daily basis. If you sort of think about it, it made sense. Water was not safe to drink, as I said, and so they used alcoholic beverages. And you think about, we still do that today. You've got alcohol, hand gel, different kind of alcohol, but you've got alcohol, hand gel, sanitizers, I'm sure, throughout the building. And they knew that a little bit of alcohol would sterilize the water and make it safe to drink. So throughout the day, they drank mead and wine and beer and all kinds of things, starting with breakfast. But the problem was, sometimes they drank too much. And when they drank too much, they went into an alcoholic stupor. And sometimes, particularly if you had been a drinker for a long time, that stupor would last for days and days. And so one of the things that, one of the traditions that came about is, if you had somebody who had passed out from alcohol, you would take the body home and you would put them on the kitchen table, and everybody would sit around and they would wait to see if that person woke up or not, or if they were indeed dead. It was sort of hard to tell. And so neighbors would come over, family would come over, because you didn't know if this was the last time you were going to get a chance to see this person, and you waited to see if they woke up, and that is where the concept of holding a wake comes from. Will they wake up or not? Usually, if they passed away, they did so in the middle of the night, and so the person with the lowest status in the house had the unfortunate responsibility of watching them in the middle of the night. And if they did pass away, then they took them off to the graveyard. And that's where the term graveyard shift comes from. Now, interesting, in Europe, particularly in England, land was at a premium. There was not a lot of room for graveyards, and so they reused graves. They actually had special bone depository areas, and so after the body had decomposed, they'd take the remaining bones and they would put them there, and then they would take the new corpse and reuse the casket and reuse the grave. And there was a period of time when they found that the inside of the caskets had scratch marks on it, that some of the people who they had presumed were dead were not, and they actually woke up when they were in the grave. And so one of the things that became fashionable for a while was constructing this little mechanism where there was a bell tied to a string, and if you woke up after you had been buried, you would yank on the string, and they would pull you out, and that's where the phrase "saved by the bell" comes from, and the person that was inside of the grave was called a dead ringer. So this is sort of fun, isn't it? You're having a good time. You're learning a few things. It's sort of fun to look into the origin of words. You know, they tell us in public speaking that when you're given a talk, particularly if they're a younger crowd, that you have to sort of like halfway through give them a break. I don't know why. I guess you guys have to check your Facebook status and see what's going on. I will tell you a little story, though. My daughter got married a couple weekends ago. I was down in South Carolina for the wedding, and we went through a Chick-fil-A. And of course, if you've been at a Chick-fil-A, you know, they always take your name and they say, okay, and they call your name out. So I always like giving them some crazy name, Persephone, because nobody knows how to spell Persephone. But one of the common ones I used, I pulled up and the lady said, what name do I put for the order? And I said, Thunderlips. And she said, what? And I said, Thunderlips. She said, like thunder and lips? And I said, yeah, you put them together and it's Thunderlips. And she looks at me like I was crazy, and I said, he was the bad guy in Rocky III. And I got nothing. Deer in the headlights. I said, Rocky? The Rocky movies? Sylvester Stallone? She looked at me like I got nothing. And I said, you don't know who Sylvester Stallone is? No. I said, okay, did you see the Creed movies? Yeah. Okay, well, Rocky was the trainer for Creed. She said, you mean the old guy who was dying from cancer? And I said, yeah. Was he a boxer? No, he wasn't a boxer. He was an actor who played a boxer. Well, what kind of movies did he do? Rocky movies. And she said, now what was that name again? I said, Frank. Just put it in as Frank. this whole generation has come and gone, who don't know Sylvester Stallone. I mean, this was a name that was common. Everybody understood. Everybody knew Rocky, right? But it's a new world. And we forget the origins. We forget that sometimes those common cultural references are lost from one generation to another. So what we're going to do next is I'm going to show you the origin of a couple other words, and I want to apply it to healthcare. For instance, by the way, bear in most European languages means brown furry thing. I'd love to give you some kind of really sexy, exciting etymology for it, but it just means brown furry thing. So let's talk about the word professional. And to do this, we're going to actually go back in time a little bit further. I want to go back to the time of Hippocrates. As you know, the Grecian and later the Roman Empire was horribly corrupt. Officials could be bribed. Judges couldn't be trusted. The business people had rigged all the weights so that you didn't get what you paid for. And unfortunately, medicine was not much different. You didn't know when you went to a doctor's office if you were going to get a magic potion that was going to make you better, or if somebody had already paid him off to give you a poison to kill you. So there was this natural animosity and suspicion between physicians and patients. So Hippocrates came along and he called for a higher moral standard. And of course, you know about the Hippocratic Oath. It says that from the beginning of life, even before the patient is born, throughout their life and up through and into death, we will respect the sanctity of that life, and we will be guided by a moral code that is going to be higher than any moral code that the government or any other system of law could give to us. Sadly, today, most medical schools do not use the Hippocratic Oath because the inconvenience of the universality of truth. It has statements in there about abortion and euthanasia and other things that are not politically popular today. But this concept of committing to a patient and having this moral code and ethic that guides you in your dealings with them was incredibly important and revolutionary in the time of Hippocrates. Now, by the time we get to the Roman Empire, the Claudius's personal physician coined the term professio, which he meant, by that he meant you make a commitment with a moral obligation to a patient, that what you're doing is not just a mere business transaction, but there are profound ethical implications that go beyond just the business side of things. There is a grievous line in the sand that you don't want to cross. That person is putting their faith and trust in you. And that's where the word professional comes from. It is a profession of faith, a profession of code or ethics. And that concept, that idea, has been what has guided us in medicine for the last several millennia. That is who we have been as physicians. That's how our profession has been guided and directed. Matter of fact, it's even been seen in the words that developed out of it, like the word patient, for instance, comes from an old Latin word, which means one who bears a suffering. The idea of a patient is somebody who's got a heavy load, and a doctor comes along and helps bear part of that load so it's not so burdensome for the patient. And that's who we've been for millennia. But a curious thing has happened in the last couple of decades in our profession, a thing that makes us question whether or not our profession can still be professional, or if our profession is being changed into an industry. And that's what I call the corporatization of medicine. See, gone are the days when a doctor came out of residency, hung up his shingle or her shingle, and practiced independently. Slowly behind the scenes for a quarter century or more, hospitals have been buying up doctors' offices. Hospitals have been merging into healthcare systems. Healthcare systems have been conglomerating into monopolies. And many experts predict that this is what will lead us to the ultimate corporatization of medicine, the largest monopoly in medicine, which will be the socialization of medicine. It's been tried twice by two different presidents, was unsuccessful. Depending on how this election goes, I predict that sometime in the next 4 to 8 years, you will probably see this concept and idea of the socialization of medicine brought back up for a third time. And all of the things behind the scenes are being laid into place for that. The amount of bureaucracy, the amount of government micromanagement, the divorcing physicians from their ability to have independent thought. Now our ability to make decisions are regulated by government entities, by healthcare insurance companies, and soon by computers as AI moves into the world and tells us what to do. And so here we are in this corporatization process. Depending on which survey you look at, you get some different numbers, but here's one particular institution that found that 3/4 of all physicians as of 2022 were in some type of employment situation, and that's much higher among percentage-wise among new graduates. If you're coming out of residency, there's a 90 to 95% chance that you're going to go into an employment kind of situation. This has led to the corporatization of our industry. Which leads to the question, is it possible, is corporate culture compatible with healthcare culture? Is the way that an MBA thinks compatible with the way that an MD thinks? And to reflect on that, let's look at a couple other words. I want to look at the word business. This comes from an old English word. It literally means, business literally means anxiety. And the word picture that it's trying to give you is this miserly old Scrooge who's sitting there counting his coins. 21, 22, 23. I only have 23 coins. I can't sleep at night. This is not enough. If I had 24, I could feel better. If I had 25, I could feel really good. What can I do to get those extra coins? And unfortunately, all of our meetings today with corporate are about money. They're not about improving patient care. They're not about addressing burnout. They're not about helping profession to remain professional. It's about bottom line. It's P&L. It's streams and streams of data points and how that translates into budgets. Matter of fact, our nomenclature has even changed. When you go to corporate meetings, we no longer call people patients. We now call them customers. The word customer comes from a Latin word. It means from whom a toll is collected, a custom or a tax or money is being taken away from. And that begs the question, who are the people that we take care of? Are they people who have a heavy burden and our ethical and moral responsibility is to come alongside them, help them carry that burden for as long as we can? Or are they people from whom we exact a toll or a price? Do we exist for their benefit or do they exist for our benefit? Two totally different models of what it means to serve in medicine versus to have those patients serve you. Etymology can be a very inconvenient truth. And an MBA would say, well, money is a necessary evil, and that may be true, but it is an evil nonetheless. You cannot serve God and mammon. You will either love the one and hate the other, or hate the one and love the other. One of the two will eventually rise. One will become subservient. The other one will become the master. And I think our challenge as we move forward into this next era of the history of our profession is to figure out how to make money to be subservient to the profession and how not to make sure that profit motive becomes our motive. Is there a different way of doing business? Can we still have a business model but do it in a different way? And I'll point to an idea that historically has been utilized, but recently has been lost, and that's the difference between a covenant and a contract. See, a covenant is an arrangement, an agreement that is made between two groups of people, two individuals, and both of them trust one another. They assume that each person has the other person's back, that you are making decisions that's best for that other person. And so the limits, the outline of how that relationship is can be fairly liberal and can allow for a lot of different things. You do what is best for the other individual, as opposed to a contract, which is an agreement that is made out of suspicion, not out of trust. It's presuming that each party has their own best interest, and so you go into that relationship trying to watch out for number one. Two totally different concepts, two different ways of relating to people. Historically, medicine has been a covenant. Today, the model is one of a contract. Corporations make contracts with physicians. Healthcare systems make contracts with insurance companies. Insurance companies make contracts with the federal government. And that has changed the way that we think about this profession and changed it into an industry. Aren't we supposed to be patient-oriented? What do you think patients think about this? Do you think they would rather have a contract, or do you think they would rather have a covenant? There's a curious paradox in medicine. If you go back 100 years ago, by the way, 100 years ago in East Tennessee, the average age of death was 47. It's now 75. We've almost, not quite, but we've almost doubled the lifespan in just a century. 100 years ago, patients were universally optimistic about the future of medicine. We had no way of treating disease. We didn't have MRI scanners. We didn't have fancy blood tests. We didn't have antibiotics. We had virtually nothing that we could do other than provide care and empathy. Now, you think about, what did a doctor do 100 years ago? He sat at the patient's bedside. He reassured them. He calmed them. He prayed for them. What did a nurse do? She came and she sat there and she fed him soup, spoonful by spoonful. Care and empathy was our main tool because we didn't have the ability to fight disease. And patients were universally optimistic about healthcare. Providers were universally positive, had positive experiences in their career and their professions. But fast forward to 2024, just the opposite. Overwhelming majority of patients have very pejorative things to say about our industry and their experiences within healthcare. Physicians are getting out of healthcare as quick as they can because there's no vision left for what we're doing. It's just we're not even called doctors anymore. They now call us providers. Management makes a decision, and we are there to pump out orders. We provide things for patients. We've lost the care part of healthcare. What do doctors do today? We sit in front of a computer, I look at a screen, I don't look at somebody in the eye. I'm typing away at data points as if I'm some type of data entry technologist. I'm clicking little boxes saying that I provided quality care rather than actually providing quality of care, which would be to turn the computer screen away, look at that person eye to eye. Patients hate it and they resent physicians for it, as they should. We have an industry in crisis. We are turning to the federal government to fix that. How has that worked for other industries in the past? Historically, has that improved things or it made things worse? Maybe what we need to do as a healthcare industry is look back in order to be able to go forward. Maybe we have to go back to the future. One other word I want to tell you about. It's the word doctor. The word doctor comes from a word that means one who is educated. And when this particular word developed in our language, it meant one who is educated, and as a result of that education, has a moral obligation to society to give the benefits of that education to everybody else. In corporate circles, physicians are seen as being the problem. We are the thing that you have to move out of the way so that business can get in and do what it needs to do. And that's not to say that corporate culture can't help an industry that has been financially malignant for decades and decades now. That may be what the doctor ordered, but what I'm saying is that if we're going to approach and try to tackle fiscal restitution within our industry, if we do so devoid of a moral context, then we've lost all the virtues of our medicine, of our industry, of our profession, and we no longer are professionals. We have become a business like any other business. Hippocrates changed the way we thought of healthcare. Claudius's private physician changed the way that you as a doctor had a relationship with patients. Maybe in 2024, Christian physicians, ones who are imbued and led by the very character and spirit of God, can stand up to an industry that's changing in a way that patients aren't happy with and probably doesn't have a very bright future, and say, we as Christians will practice medicine in a different way. We will be the ones who bring light to the darkness. We see our patients as being more than the sum total of their P&L. We look at them as being individuals with souls that God gave us and not just another line on a spreadsheet. Maybe we as Christian physicians can restore the heart and soul and help this profession that is struggling and dying to retain the virtues that has kept us honored and revered in society for decades and decades. It's going to be a wild ride. The next couple years are going to be very, very interesting. And maybe what we need to do is keep a dictionary at hand, remind ourselves where we came from, what those words mean, and where we're going. And those of us who know Christ could stand up and be light in the middle of a darker and darker world. Thank you very much.